Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for August 15th, 2024. And first of all, I want to explain what is going on with this show. Some of you may already know that I have a television show that started July 2nd. There's a studio in New York City that produces the show. So they do all the heavy lifting for me. I own all the content, of course, as I do with all my material. And the idea is that I only want to do one show per week. So the radio show is incorporated. The soundtrack, what you hear most of this show, will be from the television show. The only difficult part is that I have a lot of visuals, of course, in a television show. It's not me just sitting there talking head. I'm showing a lot of visuals. And so that's something you will miss if you have my books, etc. Most of the photographs, the pictures, the drawings, etc., would be in my books. But the idea is that I would encourage you to also watch the television show and then the archives. It's just on the same archive page as my radio show archive pages. Most of the people, there's a lot of people who listen live, but there's a lot of people who listen to the archive because they, you know, just aren't there at a very specific time of the week to listen to a live show. But at any rate, the main topic I want to talk about right now is my education package. Now, this is something that took me 4 years to develop. So there's about, I think, about 190 one-hour lectures. This is designed for K-12 and university students and their parents. And I want to emphasize this because I think it's really important for parents to understand the garbage they're pawning off to your kids in school. And especially in science, it is just horrific. And then this leads off to the history of man and the whole concept of where did we come from, who are we as people, and what they're teaching your kids is that they're just a little smarter monkey than the ones out there in the jungle. This whole idea of evolution from monkeys is really absurd. It's really absurd. And the whole history of man, how man developed, it really doesn't make any sense at all. But the problem is that is all atheist science. It assumes that all of this that you see around you just happened along by chance. It just popped out of nowhere all by itself, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. And that's what they want to do, is they want to confuse kids and get them away from the idea that there's really something much bigger. They don't talk about the human spirit. In fact, they destroy, the whole purpose of school today is to destroy the human spirit. And what do I mean by that? If you're just a little smarter monkey than the ones out there in the jungle, then you're just an animal. You're just like responding to your environment, and you have no ability to really make your way or understand your talents. Everybody is different, and all kids are different. They have different talents, and the schools fail completely at discovering the talents of kids. What do the teachers do? They come in with a textbook. Here's what you're going to learn in the next 6 months. It's all in the textbook. Makes it easy for the teachers, but it's really horrific for kids. And after sitting there for 12 years, if they're not screaming mad by then, you know, they're complacent. They're driven into complacency. So what I did is I developed this course. It's on my webpage. It's a 30% discount right now because school is starting. And I would encourage parents or grandparents to get this for your kids, and it's designed for kids, and it takes them through all my books, all of my the concepts of science, etc., and it shows them where the fallacies are in this junk that they're teaching your kids in school. So it's very important to really pursue this. So I'd encourage you to go there, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and get that education course, and it takes a long time. It's going to take a long time for kids to go through this, but the lectures are such that they can go at their own pace. So once again, the education package, Just go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, go to the top of the page. It says educational. Just click on that and then go to the education page. You can also buy my books individually or in libraries or the CDs, the DVDs, etc. But the education package contains all the books, all of my materials, including these amazing another 180 lectures that will really get them thinking and create a perception that they're very important and not this idea that they're just like the rest of the other million kids in the country, because they're not. They're all different. Okay, so with that in mind, remember now that when I'm talking about photographs and diagrams in the lecture on the radio show, use your imagination to discern what's going on here. Tonight we're going to have a little bit of fun and go back in time, actually about 33 years. And this is to a time when I made a video. I was teaching university level astronomy. And this was very interesting because what I would teach the students is that what's in the astronomy books is incorrect. But there was a grant process in the university system that gave funds to the faculty to create videos, educational videos. So I took advantage of that and was given a pretty good sum of money to create a video relative to my course. And so the name of the course was Astronomy for the 90s and was made in 1991. So I'm going to show a clip of it here. And it was professionally produced. And in those days, there was no internet, there was no electronic editing or digital. Everything was analog with tapes. And so I had a professional editor, a producer come in, did all the filming live, then edited everything, and we went back and forth doing the cut in the studio. And the end result was a video. That entire video is available on my webpage, jmccsci.com. It's called Astronomy for the 90s, and it's what I call one of the historically significant videos. And of course, in those days, it was on a VHS tape, and then it was translated into digital format on a disc. And of course, today it's available as a download electronical video. So anyway, I'm going to show a little clip of that in a minute. But remember, this is from 1991, 33 years ago. And what I did was all of these textbook companies were coming to me, and that year they all changed and updated their textbooks. And I thought, whoa, this is interesting. So they offered me free copies. So I got 21 textbooks. These are astronomy level textbooks for university level. And I took the class. I had over 100 students in my astronomy class, and so I divided them up in groups, and each group would take a series of topics, like say Venus or galaxies or Mars or whatever the topic was, and they would go through all of the textbooks to see what the textbooks all said, and then they would write a report, because they had to write a written report for as part of the astronomy course. And so this is what we did. And then the end result was the video where I summarized all those results. And basically what we found is all the textbooks said the same things, but what was interesting, they discovered, was that some authors of one textbook were the editors and proofreaders of another. So they kept their story straight. And some of the textbooks were for higher level math, professional, physics level students, that there was more technical aspects, and then all the way down to just general, some students were taking the course as a general requirement, which was interesting. So anyway, we had this entire range, but 21 textbooks. And so I'll show you a little bit of a clip of that here. And then tonight, also a little bit of something different. I'm going to go to the whiteboard and talk about a couple different topics. I'll be talking about plate tectonics, and then later in the show I'll be talking about some orbital situations, some telltale signs that we can read from the orbits of the planets.
The world's ancient civilizations used primitive, yet sometimes very accurate measuring techniques to record and predict celestial events. Today, with modern and sophisticated instruments, we are recording, measuring, and theorizing as never before. But with each new discovery and achievement, there seems to be more questions raised than answered. What we thought was true yesterday is no longer true today. The unimaginable is becoming today's newest revelation. We are just beginning to scratch the surface of this cosmic timepiece. It should not be surprising that we are finding, and will continue to find, strange and exciting new worlds, worlds so different from our own. In 1950, in what some might consider to be the beginning of modern astronomical thought, a number of concepts gained acceptance as the best explanations available to account for the evolution and workings of the solar system and universe. These axioms of astronomy have been firmly adhered to up to recent times. The nebular collapse theory of the origin of the solar system states that all the planets and moons formed at one time 4.5 billion years ago from a swirling cloud of cosmic dust and gas. No additional planets have formed since. This theory was first stated by the 18th century mathematician Pierre-Simon de Laplace. A second theory states that comets are a primordial residue of dust and ices which sublimate as these icy balls approach the sun. This theory was first stated by Johannes Kepler in the 16th century. Some scientists speculate that many of these dirty snowballs reside in a yet undiscovered location called the Oort cloud, somewhere beyond the farthest planet. A third theory states that the workings of the cosmos are governed solely by gravitational forces. A fourth astronomical axiom states that the universe began some 10 billion years ago in a colossal Big Bang. This theory, also known as the expanding universe theory, was first stated by Edwin Hubble around the turn of the century. Some astronomers believe that we can detect the residue from this explosion with modern scientific instruments. But modern discoveries and new theories are rapidly emerging. Some scientists have polarized the scientific community with new and different views of how this all began.
There are approximately 15 textbooks on the market today for introductory astronomy courses at the college level. We've got approximately a dozen of them here for review, and what we notice immediately is that they pretty much say the same thing regarding the basic theories of where the solar system came from, regarding planetary science, and regarding the origin of the cosmos. These books were published probably within the last year and a half, some within the last year. But what is amazing about the field of astronomy is it's moving at a very fast pace. And sometimes, even within the last month or a few weeks, there has been new information introduced on the scene that radically changes the way we view these theories. I'd like to, first of all, tell you a little bit about the theories that are given in the textbooks.
Hello. So this is a little test to see how this will work. We're going to do some drawing on the drawing board here. And what we have here is the mantle of the Earth with supposedly what are known as subduction zones, where one plate, which is a fallacy, but one plate is slipping under the other is slipping over, and it creates this zone that supposedly this plate then moves in this direction to create these mountains somewhere in the middle of a continent, 1,000, 2,000 miles away. So what's going on? They say that there's some kind of force here. This is a magical force. It's so magical that they can't tell you what it is. But the physics don't add up here. That's the bottom line. So there's some kind of force, but what is it, this Herculean force that makes this plate move around? The other thing I want to tell you is if you could take a piece of Earth right here and cut it out, take a big chainsaw and cut it out, this piece of Earth, and try and pick it up. Let's say it's 1 mile across by 1 mile across. It would all crumble, even if it were made of the hardest granite. Then the Earth is not made of pure hard granite. But the idea is that this is not a plate. You think of a plate like a plate of food you pick up. You can hold it at the edge and it's not going to break off and all the food falls on the floor. a plate is solid. And so the idea that of plate tectonics, which is a misnomer, is that somehow this entire plate is a single massive, very solid piece of material. So if you push here, it'll move over here, but it's not true. If you were to cut the earth here and put in giant hydraulic rams with big bulldozer blades and push apart and push this way, this plate would not move because all of the force would be consumed. It would be neutralized locally because it would just cause a lot of compression here. But so there's no magical force. And even if there were some kind of force that lifted up here, it would not translate into a force perpendicular in this direction. But let's pretend it does. Let's humor them a little bit. Now they expect you to believe that the force then takes all of this mass in the mountains and pushes it up. And the amount of energy to raise a mountain up above sea level. Now this dotted line represents the mean surface of the earth, the average surface of the earth. And so over here we have ocean, over here we have mountains, over here we have a volcano. And what happens with a volcano is that the crust and mantle are relatively thin and the magma can break through and come up to the surface. That's what we call a volcano. It's so you get a mound here of material that builds up as the volcano goes off. There's two volcano types. There's the shield volcano, which you find like in the Pacific Islands, the long sloping shield volcanoes. And then there's the explosive kind, the Mount St. Helens type, which is a cinder cone. And that would you would find the volcanoes outside of, say, Mexico City, Popocatepetl, Iztaccíhuatl, or many of the Central American volcanoes are cinder cone, where they're very explosive. And also, they're literally all over the world. Okay, but anyway, now they're expecting you to believe that this plate somehow moves sideways. And then, once again, perpendicular to that motion, pushes all of this matter up to 6 miles high. This is so absurd. There's no physics. And the real problem here is that geologists do not have physics background, because nobody that got through physics 101 would even dream of something like this, because it doesn't make any sense. Now, the other issue is that the idea that somehow mountains are created from plates moving sideways is absurd, because if this is moving sideways, you're not going to get a perpendicular force to raise this massive amount of mountains. So the question is, what is really happening? What really happens, now this is a carryover from last week where I was talking about the Earth and a large object coming by in outer space. It doesn't collide, it just comes near and sets up a differential gravitational wave. And what happens, that wave comes along, and then what happens to a wave of land when it hits a mountain range? It's going to compress, and that's where all of the energy is going to focus, and it's going to create these upthrust mountains. Now, in a minute, I'll show you a lot of photos of the peaks of mountains. The peaks of mountains are jagged, they're all ripped up. These things happen overnight in a single day. The ancients talk about this. There were events where there was mountain building, where the oceans, great tidal waves came over the land, killed a lot of people. Some of them survived to tell the tale. And so the foothills, these rolling foothills that are typically outside of the edges of mountains, that's where the waves come in. And finally, that's on the plains, the valleys that are adjacent to the mountains. And then that energy is thrust and stops because there's a mountain range there. So you find the mountain ranges, go to the Himalayas, the Rockies, the Alps, the Andes, go to any mountain range, and what you're going to find is many, you're going to find many, many epochs of mountain building. One of the great places to go see this is the southern Colorado Rocky Mountains. And you can see the waves of mountain building came in from many different directions, depending on the direction that these objects come from outer space. So once again, here we have a model of the Earth, the magma. We have a so-called continental plate, which is just Earth piled up on top of the magma, and it's cooler, so it's relatively solid. We have the ocean here. The dotted line is the average mean radius of planet Earth, a volcano where the magma gets up very close to the surface, and then a mountain range up to 6 miles high. And so this is an actual model of the Earth. It's not really to proportion, but once again to repeat, the idea that somehow there's a force here that comes up from the center of the Earth that then creates a perpendicular force, that's ridiculous, that's absurd. That's what I call silly science. It's in the realm of science that is so absurd, the only thing you can do is call it silly science. And then you're expected to believe that this plate moves along and pushes in another perpendicular direction all of this mass of mountain to create the mountains of the world. It's absolutely absurd. So the real cause of this is when large celestial objects come by and create a gravitational wave. Those gravitational waves move in the land, form the rolling hills, what we call foothills of mountain ranges. You always see them. They start to come up to a mountain range from 1,500 miles away, and they start to have some undulating hills, and then eventually you get quite a few hills, and then the mountain range. Those mountains, those hills, the foothills of the mountains are part of the wave action as it's building up, and then that wave crashes into the mountain with all of this land being thrust up in a few hours, literally in a few hours. And you can see the jagged peaks of these mountain ranges. It tells the tale. Those were not formed over millions or billions of years of slowly moving a centimeter per 10 years or whatever goofy story they try and pawn off. And this is in the textbooks. That's what I can't believe. They're teaching this plate tectonics to kids and all the way up to PhD level. It's absolute nonsense. Okay, time. I'm going to change the subject a little bit now to education. And unfortunately, what education has become is repeat what you're told and you get an A and then you're successful. And those are the people that succeed in school today. Unfortunately, most people are not taught critical thinking, how to realize baloney when they see it, etc. So I want to go back, and have you already seen a little piece of that textbook study, the video that was made in, once again, 1991, so you see me as somewhat of a younger person. And by the way, everything I said in that video is true today. That I said that the Big Bang was not true, comets were not dirty snowballs, the solar system did not form all at one time. Everything that has come to light in the last literally number of months, in the last couple of years, in fact, through standard science itself. So everything I was saying in that video 33 years ago, just imagine, we knew it then, and they were able to con the public into paying them money, paying salaries, university professors publishing peer-reviewed journals articles about what was clearly false information, false theories. But this culture of people who just repeat what they're told all the way up to PhD level and beyond is a chronic problem in the school systems. The people study, for example, when I took the SAT test to get into college, there was no preparation. You went in cold. You didn't know what this test was going to be like. There was no training. Today's students have training. They go for months training to take this test to do better, to get a better score. That isn't education. And unfortunately, what do? They become good at taking tests, not at understanding or learning about critical thinking. So at any rate, I want to go back to 1991. I'm a university faculty member teaching astronomy. I have about 100 students in my class. And so I did something one day. I want to recount this to you. I walked into class and I said, okay, at the end of class today, we're going to have a quiz. Everything I talk about in the class today, we're going to have a quiz at the end. And so they're all taking notes and they're, okay, they want to get a good grade on the quiz. And at the end of the class, I give the test, just a, 10-question quiz. And so they're all, they walk out. The next day I walk into the classroom and I hand back their papers and pretty much all of them got Fs, which means they failed. And not only failed, but failed on the majority of the questions. And they looked at it and they said, well, wait, we repeated exactly what you told us. You know, they were in agreement. And I said, yeah, that's the problem. The problem is, look at what you wrote down here. This is ridiculous. Any third grader should know that this is not true, but you wrote it down and you and they go, well, that's what you said. You're the teacher. We're supposed to respond to what you say. I said, no. You're supposed to be able to discern what's correct and what's not. I said, and they were angry. They were angry students. And I said, okay, well, today we're going to have another test at the end of the class, and today you're going to have to think. You're going to have to answer the questions based on your understanding. And so they were all like, and some of them said, you can't do that. You can't give us information and then expect us to think about it. They were actually angry that I was going to make them think. Can you imagine that? University level astronomy students. And so anyway, we went through that day and they actually had to think about what they were putting down on the piece of paper at the end of the class. Okay, that was one incident. And so I just want parents to realize when your kids are going to school, when they're talking about diversity and equity and everything else, if you look at it, 12 years of school, K-12, and really starting in kindergarten, what they're expected to do is everybody should be the same. That's not diversity. That is not diversity at all. It's the opposite of diversity and equity. Everybody's supposed to be the same. You put them in a mold. They all come out the same at graduation. No, they should all come out different. And the schools fail, and I've heard other people say the same thing. The schools are failing at finding the talents of students. Everybody's different. Everybody has a different mixture of talents. And some people may not be good at something, but can develop that, whereas some people with natural talent aren't developed at all because they're supposed to all read the same textbook and come out exactly the same. Okay, so anyway, let me go back to another thing that I would do. About the middle of the semester, they would come into the classroom. And I could see everybody was kind of like this, you know, they weren't interested. They just probably wanted to get out of there, but they were there. They had to attend class. And I'd say, okay, today we're going to do something different. Today we're going to do a little kind of a mind game. So what we'd do is I'd say, okay, pick something that, you know, you drive home or, you know, something down the block from your house that wasn't there last week and that is there now. And so somebody think, well, a broke ground for some kind of building near my house. Okay, bueno, that's good. And then how about 2 weeks ago? Think of something that wasn't there 2 weeks ago that is there now. And so they would think about that. And so what I'm doing is I'm tricking them into something. I'll get to the point in a minute. So then I'd say, okay, let's go back a month. Think of something that was not there a month ago. And then I'd go back a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years. Okay, now we're getting to the point where in, say, the Midwest states, they were in the, at that point, 1991. So go back to 1891 in the late 1800s. That's what we're talking 100 years before. They were in the pioneer days. People were settling the land, breaking it for the first time to grow crops, and maybe had a horse and a little house out in the prairie or something. You know, that's 100 years ago. 200 years ago, in those areas, white man had not even settled yet. It was Native American population, and literally millions, hundreds of millions of Native American population living in the United States. Okay, go back 500 years. Okay, now we're talking about, say, Europe, where Europe was well-developed 500 years previously. Go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, old Rome, you know, and you had the development of the Byzantine Empire, you know, historical things like that. But then go back to, say, Marco Polo opening up the spice silk route to Asia and developing, and all of a sudden finding new cultures that had not been known about. And if you go back previous to that, go back in history far enough, you will get to the point where there were these little pockets of civilization. The Polynesians were working their way across the Pacific Islands, populating them, and probably not even discovering Hawaii yet. Hawaii, a completely barren land, just waiting to be discovered by the Polynesians. And then you go to South America, and the Peruvians had a full-blown culture there. So anyway, they would get back to this point in history where cultures were starting to discover other cultures. And all of a sudden, they would, something would click. And it was interesting to watch these students figuring this out on their own. And what would click was that, wait a minute, the history of man isn't true. Because the idea that, say, 7,000 years ago, populations developed of man, the human species developed in Mesopotamia, and then spread outward, spread eastern and across the Bering Strait, and populated the United, what is now the United States, Central and South America, could not possibly be true by any stretch of the imagination. And just these simple examples would prove that. And so the students would get angry, and they would go, wait a minute, the history we've been taught is completely false. It couldn't be true. This idea of man developing and all of the black races in Africa and the short ones and the very tall ones and the you know, all of these different races, the Polynesians, all came from this one little spot in Mesopotamia 7,000 years ago. Couldn't possibly be true, but that's what they were taught. And they would get angry, really angry, that they had been taught something completely, patently false. And I said, okay, now your assignment for tonight is to go to the library and find out what the real story is and bring it back tomorrow. I want to hear what the real story is. It's got to be somewhere in the library, right? So they would go off to the library, come back to the next day, and they were even more angry because it wasn't in the library either. Everything they had been taught about the history of the human race was patently false, could not possibly be true, and they believed it. And now they understood that it was completely false, and but that was a lesson in life, literally, that don't just believe everything you hear in the classroom. Okay. So now going to have a little bit of an exercise. And this has to deal with the orbits of the planets. And once again, people have been taught that the solar system formed all at one time and nothing has happened since. There were no new planets. And by the way, in a future episode, I'll be talking about the Kuiper Belt planets. When I was a kid, we learned that there were nine planets, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, etc., then out to Pluto. And of course, they demoted Pluto from being a planet. And the reason they did is because all of a sudden, they started discovering other planets out farther beyond Pluto. Not just a few, but thousands of them. Big ones. Planet-sized objects out there. And they go, wait a minute. We thought there were nine planets, and now there's 1,009 and growing. So they had to demote Pluto from being a planet. And they said the reason was because Pluto didn't clear out the region of space in its orbit. Very ridiculous. But anyway, that's a little battle in the astronomy community that's still going on. But all of a sudden, there were thousands of planets when there were only supposed to be nine. And they had this pat story of how all the planets formed, that all at one time, 4.5 billion years ago. And of course, it's not true at all. Not true at all. So the next example I'm going to give here is going to be dealing with some residues of celestial events that have happened in the solar system. Very interesting, and this is something you can see. And by the way, when I explain these things, you don't need a PhD in astronomy or astrophysics to understand this. I explain it so you can understand, because previously what we had were the hierarchy in the astronomy astrophysics world saying, we're smart, you're dumb. We know all the you know, we've figured everything out. We'll just bequeath you some of the little bit of dribble so that you can repeat it. And that's where things stood for literally decades, literally 100 years or more. But that's not like that anymore, because you can understand when I explain things. That's one of my talents, is explaining it to people so that you, the average person on the street, and can understand exactly what's going on and understand it from a physics point of view. Okay, so we'll come back in a second, and I'm going to play the clip once again at the whiteboard talking about the residues of planet orbits.
Okay, back again at the drawing board. Now we're going to talk about some very interesting things, and I'll start this by saying that nature always leaves some telltale signs. It's like when you look at, for example, mountain building. I was talking about the upthrust mountains and the fact that these tremendously jagged peaks are there. That's a telltale sign that was just ripped out of the ground in a moment, not some long-term process. That would have had these peaks eroded, and they simply wouldn't even be there in that form today. But now I'm going to talk about a telltale sign with the planets. The planets are very interesting in that if the so-called origin of the solar system theory that they give to you in the textbooks, including astronomy, I taught university level astronomy, and I had to teach out of this textbook where I knew literally everything and it was wrong. And I would tell the students, I would tell them this is baloney, and I would tell them why, but I have to teach it because I'm in this university system and they require that I use these textbooks, you know. And so anyway, but the nature always gives you a telltale sign. And the telltale sign when you look at the planets is that their orbits are askew from the ecliptic of Jupiter. Now, I want to tell you something. When we talk about something called the ecliptic, it is the line between the center of the Sun and Earth. Now, here's Earth, here's Jupiter. I have Saturn drawn separately because it would be way off in the distance there. And then the Sun, and little Mercury here, very close to the Sun, the closest planet to the Sun. And notice, too, that when the Sun spins on its axis, it has a bulge on both sides. It surrounds the Sun. So that puts excess mass out here at the edge of the Sun. So let me explain what happens here. And by this effect, you can calculate how long it's been since Mercury or our Moon or other objects in the solar system have had some kind of celestial encounter that has thrown their orbit off of the plane of the planets. And so when we talk about, if you were to come into this solar system from afar and look at it for the first time, you would not pick little Earth here as your ecliptic. In other words, you wouldn't choose that as the plane of the planets. We do that because it's convenient from our point of view, and that's how we see the stars in the heavens. But if you were to come into this solar system and look at it for the first time, you would actually take Jupiter, which is the most massive planet. It has more mass than all the other planets put together. But that has a very good alignment with the center of the Sun and these bulges. In fact, it turns out that Jupiter is not a planet. It is a small unlit star. It's actually very hot in the infrared, has ongoing fusion in its atmosphere. I've talked about that before. But here is what happens. When an object comes into the solar system and disrupts the orbits of the planet, one of the effects is to throw its orbit out of this plane. And let me explain what happens here. As the planets orbit the sun, this bulge, guess what happens? It is out here. It's like having an extra mass here and an extra mass here. So when little Mercury is down below the plane of the planets, this blue line, it gets pulled up. And when it's over here, up above that plane, it gets pulled down in the downward direction. So it's always being pulled up into this plane. Now, what happens? After a period of time, what that means that Mercury's orbit would eventually come up and lie in this plane with Jupiter and this bulge of the sun. But it's not. It's way down here. Its orbit is way out of the plane of the solar system ecliptic, which is the sun and Jupiter's orbit around the sun. Okay, so what happens now with our moon? Our moon is way off from an ecliptic orbit. That means that recently, astronomically recently, our moon has had an encounter with some other celestial object, because if all of this formed 4.5 billion years ago and Jupiter were out there pulling everything up, the same thing happens here. When the moon is down below this ecliptic plane, it gets pulled up by Jupiter, and when it's up here, it gets pulled down. So it's always working to pull it into this plane of Jupiter's orbit. And it, actually, you can calculate how fast this happens. It's on the order of millions of years. Well, so that's not very much time in terms of astronomy. We talk about billions of years in astronomy for the development of solar system objects, etc. Now let's take a look at Saturn. Saturn has a moon, Titan. It's the biggest moon in the solar system. It's very large, but it lies perfectly in the plane of Saturn's ring system, which Saturn has a bulge also. And so that means that Titan has been there for a very long time undisturbed by something coming from outside. And that you would probably expect that out in the far distant end of the solar system where Saturn spends its time. But that tells you that Titan, this big moon of Saturn, has been in that orbit for a very long time, because if it were out of that orbit, it would be pulled into that plane of Saturn's bulge and the ring plane, which is perfectly aligned with that bulge. And so it would eventually get pulled into that. But that tells us the story of the history of Titan. But the moon of Earth, and in fact Earth itself, is out of the plane of Jupiter's ecliptic plane. Mercury is a very big telltale sign indicating that Mercury has had an encounter with some other large celestial object, probably a large comet coming into the solar system with a great big nucleus, that moved near the sun and threw it out of its ecliptic plane orbit. So this is a little indicator that, like I say, nature always leaves a telltale sign behind to let you know what's going on, if you know to look for it. But you won't find this in any astronomy textbook, because it blatantly contradicts their story that the solar system formed all at one time. So remember, the Big Bang did not happen. We know that now. The solar system did not form all at one time. It's had many interactions recently. So the solar system did not form all at one time. Comets are not dirty snowballs. We know that. They're something very different. They're the discharge of the solar capacitor, and the very big ones can become planets like planet Venus. And the list goes on, and talking also about plate tectonics. Silly science. This is what they're teaching to your kids. So I can't believe it. But anyway, I also want to talk about Mars here. Mars is the next planet out here from Earth. And it shows riverbeds. If you look at the pictures of riverbeds on Mars, They're very recent, and geologists who know what they're talking about will tell you that the geology of Mars, the water erosion, is very recent. And so that means that Mars lost its oceans and atmospheres probably within the last 10,000 years. Well, how did that happen? It was a blue planet. The ancients tell us that. It happened because a large celestial object came by which removed the atmosphere and oceans from Mars. It used to be a water planet. So anyway, this is the way the solar system actually works, not what they teach you in a textbook.
Last week, I mentioned that this week I would be talking about advanced propulsion systems, electromagnetic propulsion systems, and a different way to move around in outer space. But I postponed that a week because I wanted to talk about some of these basic concepts of astronomy. I think it's very important that people understand that what you're being taught about astronomy is not exactly correct. In fact, it's really completely wrong. And point out some of these very simple concepts of astronomy. But the next part, I want to actually revert back to the video I showed, a short clip, Astronomy for the 90s. As once again, I was teaching university level astronomy in 1991 and got a grant to make this video. So I want to refer to that and have myself as a much younger person describe some of the situation with Mars and Venus. And also understand that I developed a course that is now available on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And it's for K-12 University. It's about 200 lectures. It comes with all of the books and CDs. And this DVD is part of the collection of the historically important videos going back into the early 1980s. You see me as quite a younger person talking about similar things. And so I just want to let you know that those are available. Go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Go up to the educational part. And I recommend these for parents and also grandparents. If you want to get your grandchildren something really useful, a few hundred lectures telling them how to think critically and talking about a vast number of topics that really you're not going to learn in school. Unfortunately, the schools today are on this program of textbooks, teaching from textbooks that are really very outdated. That's the best thing you can say about them. So anyway, without further ado, I'll just play this clip and then I won't come back again at the desk here, but I'll see you next week. But watch the rest of this video. It is, once again, from 1991. The Astronomy for the 90 is the video name. And take a look, talking once again about Mars and Venus.
Mars has very much indicated to us that it had water, large volumes of water in an atmosphere much like our own, where there was rain and rivers and oceans, and there had to be a massive atmosphere much like our own to hold this water in place. Mars today has a very small atmosphere, hardly there at all, just enough to cause large dust storms to blow around the planet. But if you look at the surface of Mars, there are riverbeds that rival the Mississippi and other major rivers of the world. They meander and snake through the lowlands. And one thing we know from geology on Earth is that a meandering, snaking river is a very old river. It took many millennia to form that riverbed, as we see it from space today on Mars. The other thing is, for example, at the Olympus Mons, the massive volcano on Mars, it's three times higher than Mount Everest, and its base is approximately the size of the state of Colorado. At the base of this massive shield volcano, typically a shield volcano tapers off where the lava had flowed for centuries. And what we notice is at the base of Olympus Mons, there's a tremendous amount of erosion. Once again, indicating that Olympus Mons probably sat in the middle of a large ocean at one time. Now, the other point about Mars is we know that there are massive dust storms that occur yearly on the planet. And these are significant enough to erode geological features. So the features that we see, the rivers and other erosion-type formations, were formed over a long period of time in a planet that had a significant atmosphere with a significant amount of water, and none of that is there now, but if Mars would have lost its atmosphere a long, long time ago, and therefore its water, these features would no longer be visible because the dust storms would have eroded them away. So the question is, what happened with Mars? Another enigmatic planet is Venus. The Magellan probe probably gave us more information about Venus than we had about the Earth even 10 years ago. We now have mapped the entire surface of Venus, and what's interesting is that there are over 1 million volcanic calderas on Venus. Now, can you imagine Earth with 1 million volcanic craters? It would be quite a different planet. Venus has an atmosphere that's approximately 900 times that of Earth. The temperature at the surface of Venus is hot enough to melt lead, and it rains sulfuric acid out of the sky. Tremendously hostile environment. For probably 2 to 3 decades, it's been suggested that the greenhouse effect is the cause of the high temperature of Venus. But now that we've mapped the surface of Venus, we know that, in fact, there are volcanoes, and if you look at the volcanic process, volcanoes are indicative of heat being belched out of the interior of the planet. If the greenhouse effect were, in fact, the source of high temperature on Venus, you would expect the planet to be heated from the outside inward, with the surface melting first and the heat gradient going gradually to a cooler temperature inside the planet. Volcanism definitely tells us that the interior of Venus is hotter than the outside layers. So that's one indication that Venus is, in a sense, a very different planet than what we expected. Another problem with the greenhouse effect, which has been suggested many times, is that it violates the second law of thermodynamics. The temperature profile of Venus, as you go up in altitude from the planetary surface, the temperature goes down, which means that the cloud layers around Venus are cooler. For the greenhouse effect to work, radiation comes in from the sun, hits the planetary surface, is radiated off, collected by the clouds, where in the infrared region of the electromagnetic spectrum, and then would be radiated back down to the surface to heat the surface. The problem is, the second law of thermodynamics clearly states that you cannot have heat transferred from a cooler area to a warmer area. And so the greenhouse effect provides no mechanism for this heat to be transferred from the cooler clouds to the warmer planetary surface. Another problem with the greenhouse effect, which has been stated many times, is that there's not enough light hitting the Venusian surface because of the tremendously thick clouds which shroud the planet. Approximately 1/1000th the amount of light necessary to make the greenhouse effect work is entering the lower regions of the atmosphere. The textbook explanation for that is that there is enough light at the Venusian surface to cause shadows. You may remember your bathroom nightlight, which also causes shadows, but hardly has enough energy to melt a planetary surface. So these are just questions we're raising. We're not finding solutions. We're not suggesting any alternatives. We're just saying that there's a tremendous amount of new information which alters the way we think about these concepts. Then we turn to cosmology, the bigger picture of the universe. The Big Bang theory explains that the universe formed in an immense uniform explosion, and the matter that we see, the galaxies and other structures in the universe, came from this massive explosion. The theory states that there should be a very uniform distribution of matter as you go out in the universe, especially as we look back into time, as we look farther and farther out into the universe. The COBE satellite measures the background radiation and has shown us to one part in 100,000 that this background radiation in the microwave region, 3 degrees Kelvin, is very uniform. At approximately the same time as the COBE satellite was mapping the microwave background radiation, Other astronomers were mapping the positions of galaxies in the cosmos. They took thin slices of the celestial sphere and mapped the positions and the locations of galaxies. They put the information into a computer, and what they found was there are enormous walls and sheets and strings of galaxies with enormous voids in between. And on the largest scale that they can detect today, through all the studies that have been done, there is no average density in the universe. In other words, the universe is not uniform as was expected. The question is, are we looking into a microwave background radiation that in fact is coming from the original Big Bang? Or other astronomers suggest that this is simply a background heat from dust clouds that exist in our galaxy, and we are simply detecting the heat from these very cool dust and gas clouds that surround our solar system as we move through the Milky Way galaxy. All these questions rest on many theories. Problem with a lot of cosmology and planetary science is you cannot get these things into your laboratory to make measurements. So we rely on measurement at a distance, remote sensing of many types, and the interpretation of this data. And herein lies what you may call the politics of science. The theories that are proposed, whose theory gets to be placed in the textbook, etc. These are the questions that we're going to try and at least raise at this time.
Just remember that you can see all of the visuals on the TV show that airs. This would have aired live on Tuesday evening, August 13th. All of the archives for that are, there are I think four or five platforms with the audio and the video, the visual, and then there's about 15 other platforms where just the audio plays. And so you'll find all of that on my webpage, jmccsci.com. Just go up the top. It has radio and podcast archive. So just click on that, go down there, all the different ways to listen. If you miss it live, which actually the vast majority of people listen, watch to the archives. And so as soon as the live show ends, just like this show for 24 years, as soon as it ends, then it will post. As soon as we get the links together, it will post, and then you can go listen to the archives. Okay, so anyway, I'm about out of time here, so once again, visit the webpage, jmccsci.com, that has the links to the water filter page, the wind energy page, the grow tower page, everything, and a lot of information, and of course, 24 years of this radio show archived there. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.